This is a Cato Special podcast. I'm Caleb Brown. The screw-ups with regard to surveillance of Trump campaign advisors have focused some rare attention on broad federal surveillance powers. Much of that attention is aimed at how the most secretive court in America does its job. Rand Paul is the junior U.S. senator from Kentucky. He doesn't believe the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court can be made constitutional, but he's still offering changes to how it does its job. We spoke today. For those who've been following it, there are substantial systemic problems with the way that the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court operates. Some of those were highlighted by surveillance of political advisors to the Trump campaign in 2016. What is the largest problem that you see in how intelligence agencies are able to do their work that is problematic for the rights of Americans?
You know, I don't think the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court is constitutional. They work on a standard that is less than the constitutional standard. So the Fourth Amendment says that you can get a warrant if you have probable cause to believe a crime has been committed or going to be committed. This Foreign Intelligence Court works on a standard that says you have probable cause, not of a crime being committed, but probable cause that someone has an association with a foreign government. So that's not in our Constitution, and it's a lower standard than the Fourth Amendment. So right now we're going through this debate in Washington. How can we reform or make it less likely that the FISA court could be used to investigate a political campaign or a political person? So some of the reforms are like having an amicus or a friend of the court that sort of argues kind of like you have a lawyer, but you don't have a real lawyer, but it would still be done in secret. So I don't think that any of the patchwork reforms, although I may support some of them, I don't think any of them fix the situation. I think the FISA court cannot be made constitutional. So what I'm advocating for and what my amendment is to take Americans and U.S. persons out of the FISA court and say, if you want to investigate them, you can do it the way you traditionally investigate Americans. And that's using the Fourth Amendment, going to an Article III, a regular constitutional court, and asking for a warrant. It happens all the time. In fact, there are complaints that those warrants are too easy to get, much less a FISA warrant, which is basically a rubber stamp. But I think what happened to President Trump should never happen again. We have an ideal time to actually reform it, but I've been disappointed that some of the bipartisan groups that have been involved with this have just sort of laid down and said, oh, the best we can do is an amicus, you know, in the FISA court, when in reality, there ought to be more people standing up and saying what I'm saying is that this court can't be made constitutional for Americans, and therefore we should exempt Americans from this court.
When it comes to surveillance, when Americans are the subjects of surveillance or even just sort of tertiary, they have their information swept up, there's a good chance that they will never, ever, ever know about it. Is that something that ought to change? That is, should Americans eventually be told if they've been swept up with one of these warrants?
Yeah, there's no way to have justice if you can't protest against what the government's doing to you. In fact, many people have commented that the only reason we're hearing about this is because Trump won. If Trump would have lost, this would have been swept under the rug. Hillary Clinton would have never mentioned it. The intelligence community would have covered their tracks. So this is an amazing power. This is enormous power. I used to say that, you know, when I first read 1984, I wasn't so worried about it. I was in high school in the late 1970s, and it's like, we don't have two-way television sets. We don't have all this technology. Now we do. So surveillance is a very scary thing. I mean, the NSA has revealed that 1 month they collected every phone call from Italy. We listen to Angela Merkel's cell phones. They can do anything and everything to anyone. So we have to have safeguards, and power is a corrupting influence. And so you want as little as possible. And one way to draw parameters around the power to surveil is we should say, let's spy on, you know, people who might attack us, who are our enemies, who are foreigners, but let's don't spy on Americans. And if you want to spy on Americans, just go to a regular court. But there you get a lawyer. Even if it's done secretly and they tap your phone, later on you're notified of it. And your lawyer can go to the judge and say, they tapped my phone because I'm a Christian or I'm a Jew or I'm an atheist. They tapped my phone they didn't have real reasons. And you can sue and you can win, actually, in that case. And there's a long history of that. But in a secret court like FISA, you never are notified. And that is a problem. Could you make it less bad by notification? Yeah, but I don't think any of the reforms being offered have notification in them. There's some kind of records exchange where the amicus gets some more information, which will help. But I don't think that any of it says that the target actually gets his information. But the bottom line is, and Judge Napolitano and others have written a lot about this, the adversarial process is one of the most important things in court that bring about justice. And courts aren't perfect. We hope they bring about justice. But when you have a lawyer on each side, both sides get the information. We actually tell the prosecutor, you have to divulge the stuff beforehand so the defense can research your evidence to see if it's true or see if they can debunk your evidence. That becomes this adversarial court process that tries to get to justice. But when it's secret, you don't get a lawyer, and you don't even get informed of a crime, there's no way that can be justice. And I'm just disappointed that more people gave in on this. Even the president's biggest defenders, who had all these rallies chanting and cheering, down with FISA, do this to FISA, they're going to keep FISA. They're going to give us window dressing, and nothing will change. And this is a real disappointment for me. We'll see. I am going to support some of these amendments that would make it less bad. But in the end, I won't vote for the bill because I'm not for any part of the Patriot Act. This reauthorizes the Patriot Act, and I won't vote for the final passage. Actually, even if my amendment won, I wouldn't vote for the final package. But I do believe that it was a somewhat of a victory to get a vote on my amendment and to get to debate it. I'll debate. I'll have a floor speech today and tomorrow on the Patriot Act and on my amendment. And getting a vote, you know, is somewhat of a victory because it's like pulling teeth to get a vote. You have to demand and you have to threaten to obstruct and you have to threaten them with being here on the weekend to get anything done. And I do all of those things. And as a consequence, I've been able to get more votes than probably any other senator up here. And people look at me and say, why do you get a vote again? I say, well, because I threatened them with staying here on the weekend. They're not happy to give me a vote, but they know I'll make them stay and they know I'm not bluffing. And so I do get quite a few votes.
I don't have a strong sense of how the president will react to this legislation, either with or without your amendments. Do you have a better sense?
You know, I keep encouraging him to veto it if my amendment doesn't pass because I don't think the other reforms are real. I think he's torn because I think he likes Attorney General Barr on some things where Attorney General Barr has been a stronger attorney general than previously we've had. But I think on others, he knows that Barr really is part of the institutional apparatus of the deep state. Frankly, I mean, Barr was one of the original authors of collecting metadata. You know, that goes all the way back to the early 90s when they were doing it on so-called drug dealers, but they were collecting a lot of metadata on innocent Americans as well. And Barr was a co-author of this, coincidentally with Mueller. So it's kind of funny how, you know, the president has this visceral reaction to people like Mueller, but then he appoints somebody who's a longtime ally of Mueller and a longtime part of, you know, you can call it the deep state. Another less inflammatory term is the establishment of the intelligence community who really don't believe in civil liberty. So it is disappointing. And I think he's torn. I think the president's gut would be with me, and he always tells me he is. But then I think he's torn by having so many people around him saying, oh, the world will end and we'll be overrun by terrorists if we don't give up our liberties.
Shifting gears just a little bit, you spoke with Dr. Anthony Fauci yesterday about COVID-19. You stressed that there are real substantial trade-offs associated with maintaining lockdowns, keeping schools closed, and other mandates. But of course, mandates can't last forever. To the extent that governors are calling the shots, and I've been assured that they do have some legitimate authority in this arena, are there governors that, in your view, are doing a good job handling this very difficult time?
I think one of the big questions is whether kids should go back to school. So my debate with Dr. Fauci was, he says that he claims that he's giving us advice based on facts. Well, here's a fact. And he doesn't dispute this, but he did obfuscate the point. The fact is this, between 0 and 18, the death rate is virtually zero. Not zero, but virtually zero. So what was his response to me? Oh, we've had some deaths from Kawasaki's disease, which is an autoimmune post-viral syndrome. Well, that's true, but that ignores the argument, because if two or three kids die from this in New York, that's still not statistically significant. And if we're talking about making decisions where no kid goes to school in New York or no kid goes to school in Kentucky, shouldn't we talk about whether it's 1% of children dying or 10 or 15? If you tell me 15% of children are going to die or 5% of children are going to die, I'd be for, you know, not going to school. I wouldn't send my kid to school, frankly. But if you tell me that the death rate for children is about the same as the death rate for the flu, and that is a fact, It's much higher for the elderly than the flu, and the overall rate is higher than the flu. But the death rate, pairing them one against another, 0 to 18, probably is a little bit worse for the flu. Age 18 to 45, the statistics from New York, were 10 deaths per 100,000. So we have to put this in perspective. And so they all say, well, we love these experts because they're scientists and they're basing it on facts. Well, those are facts. And he talked about closing school, not opening school till we had a vaccine. And that's an opinion not really based on all the facts if we're not going to look at mortality. So we have to look at mortality. Are there some governors better than others? Probably. But all the governors are doing too much to hamper the economy. We're in a massive economic calamity right now, and it's caused by government. It's caused by government-enforced quarantine. It's not a lack of money. You cannot print up enough money. You cannot borrow enough money from China to fix it. It's a lack of commerce, not a lack of money. And the only way we get better is we have to open up the economy.
Rand Paul is a U.S. senator from Kentucky. We spoke today. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast wherever you please and follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.